Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of one man's determined push for peace in the Middle East. Bassam Araman was raised in the West Bank, where he was taught to hate the Israelis. He saw people getting shot. He threw stones during the Intifada. And when he was older, he joined Fatah and started to run with militant Palestinians. When he was all of 17, he was arrested and sentenced to 7 years in an Israeli prison.
If you read my cheer chart, you will see that I am a big terrorist, according to the Israeli, planning to destroy or to damage Israeli patrols and to make the Israeli population in a dangerous situation.
Bassam concluded that the violence was useless, and he became an advocate for peace, joining with former Israeli soldiers to end the killing. Even after his own daughter was shot and killed, he continues to press for peace. I'll talk with him right after the news. This is a story of two men, one of them Israeli and one Palestinian. They made a commitment to each other 3 years ago that they would set aside their weapons and work for peace. Bassam and Yonatan have met and spoken and traveled and talked, and people listen, and it has made a difference. But in the end, they are just two more former soldiers who are fed up with war and looking for a better way and a better place to raise their children. And so today's story is actually about just one of those children, a 10-year-old Palestinian girl. Her name was Abir. She was Bassam's daughter, and she was shot and killed by a rubber bullet 1 year ago. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
On the day the 10-year-old Abir was killed, she had gone to school. Her parents got some confusing phone calls. She was hurt. She'd been shot in the hand. Her father, Bassam, was the one who got to the local hospital where she'd been taken.
When I reached there, I saw her. I knew that she's in a very difficult situation. And my doctor, he's a doctor, he told me that she needed a miracle to stay alive. Then she spent 2 days and she died.
She'd been shot in the head with a rubber bullet.
Yeah.
Was there ever any question, any doubt, who shot that bullet?
No, never. It's just one shot. It's one shot.
Did you ever find out how it happened?
From the witness. The driver opened the door and looked at her while she fell down. I met the same driver after just 2 weeks, and he told me that we shot her because throw stones on us. They know that they shot her, and he see her. Why they don't go to help her, to bring her to the hospital? It's very clear, and I haven't any doubt that the Israeli border police kill Abir.
I can't imagine anything that would test my heart and mind as a parent, like the killing of a child. Bassam Araman had made his commitment to the peace process years earlier. He spent the 2 previous years meeting with former Israeli soldiers, the same men who'd now taken his daughter's life. And yet 3 weeks after her death, he wrote this. It would be easy, so easy to hate, to seek revenge, find my own rifle, and kill 3 or 4 soldiers in my daughter's name. That's the way Israelis and Palestinians have run things for a long time. Every dead child, and everyone is someone's child, is another reason to keep on killing. But Bassam did not do that. He told me that he is more committed to peace now, and that he does it in the name of his daughter, Abir. So let's go back with him to find out how he got to such a place. We're also going to hear from a former Israeli military pilot who's now one of Bassam's friends, but we're going to start with Bassam when he was a boy, growing up in the West Bank. He was 13 years old when he saw Israelis kill a fellow student at a demonstration.
They follow him and another group of students until to the mountain, and he was throw stones. They was very far away from him. Then they shot him and kill him. I see him how he's dying directly. It looks like a shock for me. It's the first time. It's not a film. It's not a movie. It's reality. At the same day, I see another fellah in his in the valley. He's working. They came to shoot him 6 bullets in his legs, every leg 3 bullets, and he's crying. And we was 4 students who are crying for him also and shout to the people to carry him. There is no cars.
This man who was shot in the valley, he was a farmer?
Yeah, he don't involved in anything. He don't know that there is administration in the village even.
3 bullets in each leg?
Yeah, I became very angry. I decide to fight or to seek revenge because it would be happened to me also. And this is push me to start to fight.
Now, did you join one of the militia, Fatah, Hamas, something like that?
No, we start to create a local group, like 5 students from our classroom. We support Fatah movement, but we are officially not Fatah.
Did you have any weapons?
Yeah, after we spent maybe 2 years throwing stones and wrote to the walls like freedom for Palestine and raising the Palestinian flag, it's not work to prevent those people to come to our village. Then we start to think that we must found another thing effective to fight them. And fortunately or unfortunately in that time, we found and old weapons like Kalashnikov and 2 grenades and a lot of bullets. And my group, they used it against the Israeli soldiers in our village, and no one injured in that time, 1985.
You didn't kill any Israelis at that time?
No.
But you were put in jail, is that right?
Yeah.
On the day that you were arrested, though, were you doing something?
In that day, no.
Why were you picked up?
They have information about the group.
Uh-huh.
And they arrest us.
Did you have a trial?
Yeah, I have 2. But in these trials, I don't know my sentence. Just after we go out the current, I know that they sentenced me 7 years.
How old were you at that time, Bassam?
I was 17 years.
And you got 7 years in prison?
Yeah.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Bassam Araman was a Palestinian committed to hating Israelis. While he was in prison, his thinking was altered when he saw a film about the Holocaust. Now, Bassam knew it was a film about Jews being taken to the death camps, and he was actually looking forward to seeing it.
I wish that Hitler killed all the Jews because it's very simple. I'll not be in their jail now. But the fact that after 15 minutes in this film, I found myself crying for those innocent people who are waiting to die for nothing, I cannot prevent myself to cry. And I forget that I'm crying for a Jewish people. It's the same thing which I saw in the first Intifada. Palestinian woman shot and killed in her head also from the Israeli soldiers. It's the same. I see also the Jewish people, how they burned them alive with their bulldozers. And it was in the first Intifada also in Nablus village called Salem. They burned 4 Palestinian young with their bulldozers, the Israelis. I try to convince myself why the Israelis are very aggressive, the Israeli soldiers. If any Palestinian kid throw 1 stone, you will have dozens of jeeps of Israeli soldiers. And I said, it's because of this tragedy, because of this Holocaust. But at the same time, you reach the point that I am not Hitler. I am not the Palestinians not doing that to the Jews, to the Israelis. At the same time, I don't want the Palestinian prisoners, my friends, to see me crying. They will know that I'm crazy. You are crying for your enemy. It's a paradox. It's a very difficult. I try to convince myself that this is just a movie and it's not reality. But in this film, I became also more angry about the Israelis or the Jews because they are don't struggle or defend themselves against the Nazi regime. You must fight to prove that you are here.
Bassam Araman says he seriously started to rethink conflict in the Middle East when he began a series of conversations with one Israeli jailer. The man was a right-wing Israeli, a hardliner. He thought all the Palestinians in jail were terrorists, and he said that to Bassam.
You are just killers, the Palestinians. And in this conversation, I see that he believes that we are settlers. Then when I understand that, I told him that let us agree every time you are here to make this dialogue. And if you convince me that we are settlers as a Palestinians, I'll stop fighting and I'll say I was wrong. And he agreed.
He called you a terrorist. They treated you badly. You called him a terrorist. Why did you think to talk to him? What did you think it would change?
First of all, because he started to talk with me. Second, in jail, it's a very special community, very special conditions. You must prove that you are strong enough to stay alive even. I don't believe that or blame that I am going to change his mind or to be friends, just to answer him on his question.
How many times did you speak, you and this jailer?
Many times. After this conversation, we speak more than 7 or 8 months until he came support to the Palestinian people. He understand our suffering. He understand why we are fighting. And he said that once, that you are fighting at least for your honor or for your respect.
Bassam, what did you say to this man to make him change his mind? You turned him around.
The key was to realize that both of us are human beings. And if you look to the other side as a human being, he realized that I am like him. I want to live in peace. And he understand why I'm fighting. I am not a fighter. I was a child and I found myself as a fighter. And he became sympathy with me.
I want to understand something here, though, Bassam. You changed his mind. But did he change your mind? Did he help you see something differently?
Actually, yeah. When I see that, according to me, this killer or criminal, he also accept me. Yeah, he changed something. That maybe we can live together. Then I start to talk to every extremist jailer. And one of them told me that his officer told him, just don't speak to that man because he's very dangerous.
They said you're dangerous?
Yeah.
What, because you're changing people's minds?
Yeah, and he said, I know that now you are very dangerous for the idea.
These guys didn't want to change their minds.
Mm-hmm.
But some Israelis were ready to rethink the conflict. One of them was a well-trained, highly decorated Black Hawk helicopter pilot in the Israeli military. His name is Yonatan Shapira, and he has since become Bassam's counterpart in the group Combatants for Peace. We'll meet him in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The latest news from the Middle East tells of a desperate push by Palestinians to resupply themselves in the Gaza Strip. For years, Gaza has been closed off by Israeli leaders who say it's home to too many terrorists. This week, the border wall between Gaza and Egypt was blown up, and Palestinians are scrambling to get medicine and food. And as dramatic as that seems, it really doesn't change the conflict in the Middle East. Palestinian militants continue to fire rockets at Israel. Israeli jet fighters and tanks continue to fire back at them. Today I'm talking with two former soldiers who are a part of the push for peace. Bassam Araman is a Palestinian. His counterpart is a former Israeli helicopter pilot named Yonatan Shapira. Yonatan says he flew many missions into the occupied territories. It was what he'd always wanted to do as a patriotic young Israeli.
I wanted to fly in the sky and... So for me, it was a great combination of being, a good citizen, but also benefiting from that.
How did you feel about the idea that to protect Israel, you might have to bomb or shoot Palestinians?
In those days, I was not aware of the pain and the suffering of the Palestinian side. I was completely aware in the suffering of the Israeli side. I volunteered for many years for organizations that give aid and support to victims of suicide bombers. So the notion of maybe I will have to participate in a war or in a violent conflict where I have to kill in order to defend my people was something that it didn't make me happy, but I knew that's part of the job, that's part of my obligation to my people.
But Yonatan, if you were a helicopter pilot, you would have seen the difference in the living conditions. You would have flown over these refugee camps and places like Gaza and places where the Palestinians were all crushed together. You would have seen the difference between their life and the life of many Israelis.
Yeah, that's definitely right. I flew many missions. I didn't have to shoot anyone. I flew rescue missions and I landed commando forces. But you're right, I saw the occupied territories from above. I saw the settlements and I saw the refugee camps. I even remember once, just when I was a very young pilot, I went to rescue a soldier that was stabbed by a Palestinian fighter in Gaza. And eventually we ended up bringing both of them, the Israeli soldier and the Palestinian fighter that was shot by friends of the soldiers that was wounded. And both of them were laying on the back of the helicopter. I was flying both of them to hospital. And I think I started to think about this whole weird situation, why these guys are trying to kill us and what this is all about.
When you say that you didn't kill anyone yourself, at the same time, if you're flying commandos around, you are a part of that military machine that is killing people, though, right?
Of course, that was something that took me also a long time to understand, that it doesn't matter if I shoot myself someone or if I land soldiers that will shoot someone, whether it's in Lebanon or in Hebron or in Gaza, I have to take responsibility for what these soldiers are doing. And it occurred to me in a very late stage in this process that I'm part of this circle of violence.
As you can hear listening to Yonatan Shapira, he had already started to struggle with his own feelings on the way that violence was being used by both sides.
I was always against occupation and against the settlements, but I managed somehow to separate my political ideas and my thoughts from me being a pilot in the Air Force and part of the system. I thought that as a citizen I have to vote and I have to participate in the democratic process, but as a soldier, as an officer and pilot, my job is to follow orders and hope that they will lead to the right thing. The idea or the notion of refusing was simply not a part of my dictionary. It was something that was completely out of my spectrum of thinking.
What changed for you? What was it that changed your mind?
Several things. One of them was that during the Second Intifada, Sharon's government started to use assassinations against the Palestinian suspects.
Israeli helicopters would shoot missiles at carloads of people in Gaza, and the explanation was that the assassination of the leaders was the only way to stop the terrorism.
Yeah, and it's still happening nowadays, and many Palestinians died, including innocent children. And for me, I think that was one of the straws who broke the camel back, because I couldn't justify anymore the way my leaders handled this conflict. I felt that it's just a circle of revenge, and I didn't see the point of targeting suspects, even if they were involved in bad things and crimes against my people. When you kill other innocents next to them, you do the same thing that you are against. You know, you are saying that you have to protect innocent Israelis from getting killed by suicide bombers, but you send pilots to drop bombs and missiles that eventually kill innocent Palestinians. So how can you justify struggling against terror by becoming terrorist yourself?
Was there any one attack that sticks in your mind?
Yeah, there was one specific attack in the summer of 2002. In the middle of the night, an F-16, a fighter plane, drop a one-ton bomb, which is equal to maybe more than 100 suicide bombers' belts, explosive belts. So they dropped it on the house of one of the leaders of the Hamas in Gaza, and of course they killed him, and with him 15 other innocents, 9 children and babies, and 100 or 200 of people were severely injured, and many buildings were damaged.
Yeah.
And when I saw the photos, the pictures in the news and in TV, I couldn't believe that, you know, it's one of these nice pilots that maybe I saw a few days ago in the Air Force base, or maybe it's one of my friends. It could have been me if, you know, if I would be to serve in this squadron. It shook everything. I couldn't continue to live with this kind of self-denial. And what made everything even more hard for me was the reaction of the commander of the Air Force. He said that this mission was perfectly executed and the pilot did a great job and they should sleep well at night. And as if it was not enough to see the results of this attack, to hear what my commander, and in the Air Force it's like a family. You feel it's, you know, it's a club, it's a very exclusive club that you feel that you are related in a way to all the members. And the commander is, you know, it's like your big father. And to hear my superior commander saying something so horrible and so disgusting, in a way, woke me up, not just me, but many other fellow pilots in the Air Force. I think that sometimes when someone tells you to sleep well, it's the best way to wake up.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. What happened next is something that was well covered in the international news. Yonatan Shapira and 26 other Israeli pilots decided to hold a news conference to express their displeasure.
Highly decorated Israeli Air Force pilots are refusing to carry out targeted assassinations in the West Bank and Gaza.
The pilots' petition was itself a bombshell. "We oppose carrying out attack orders that are illegal and immoral," it said. "We refuse to continue to injure innocent civilians," it went on. "These actions are a direct result of an extended occupation that is corrupting the Israeli society as a whole."
I didn't feel that I'm turning on the family. I felt that I'm doing it also for this family, because they are lost. They are doing the wrong thing, not just for the Palestinians, but they're acting against themselves, they're against their own interests.
But Yonatan, were you sure that you were right, or were you a little bit nervous doing this?
I was nervous because it's frightening to do something that will put you on the spot and you will have to talk about it in, you know, in TV and in the radio, and to justify yourself and to answer hard questions and to stand in front of your friends and in front of your commanders. But I was completely sure. I was never sure about something in my life like I was those days.
Even when people called you a traitor?
Yeah, because that was quite obvious that some of the people will not be able to accept these facts about reality. And in order to survive with themselves, they had to somehow delegitimize us. And I wish everyone could feel this feeling of doing something that you are completely sure about. I still remember the moment that I sat in front of the Air Force commander in his office when he dismissed me.
This was a dishonorable discharge, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, right? Yeah, dishonorable discharge, and for me it was the most honorable discharge I could ever think about. And I still remember how he sat next to his desk with the Israeli flag in one side and the Air Force flag in the other side. And he was extremely nervous, and I felt so strong. I felt that not just I'm whole with myself, I'm sure and complete with my views and my actions, but I felt also that the humanity is on our side, is on my side, and not on his side.
Do you think he knew that?
I think he felt a bit nervous because he kept asking me, what do I write over there? Because I kept writing notes to myself. And he said, what are you writing over there? And I said that this is a very important moment for me and maybe for you and maybe for history, and I want to remember what happened here. And actually, we talked for maybe an hour and a half or so. And during the conversation, I asked him, how come a young lady is going to kill herself in order to kill innocent Israelis? How is it possible? What are the circumstances that led to these things to happen? And he said he doesn't want to talk about these things. And then, after other questions I had to ask him, he said that there is a ladder of Bloodworth where the Israelis are on top and the Palestinians are on the bottom. At that moment, I understood that if I had any doubts, this was the last proof I had to get from him, that it's also connected to racism. When you see children and you say that they're worth less than other children, it's the beginning of the end. It's the beginning of the destruction of yourself, of your humanity, of your everything that you believe in.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. And this is a part of today's story when the former Israeli pilot meets the former Palestinian militant. Earlier this hour, I was talking with Bassam Araman about his decision to become an advocate for peace on the Palestinian side. And so the meeting was set for Bethlehem, a place that was as close to neutral ground as they could find.
We were very nervous. We didn't know what will happen to us because we used to go to the occupied territories, but with tanks, jeeps, helicopters, weapon, helmets, uniform. And this time we went with a notebook and T-shirt.
Bassam, do you remember this first meeting?
Yeah, of course. It was the most difficult meeting. We was four Palestinians and there are seven Israelis. And it's the first time you are going to meet your real enemy, the same soldier who tortured you, who arrested you, who damaged the houses. Actually, the first meeting, he speak freely about his torture to the Palestinians. He was the officer of Kalandia checkpoint, and he was the officer responsible for the damaging of the headquarters of Arafat while Arafat was there. Wow, I don't believe myself. At the beginning, I want to eat him. What's he say? Then he told me that you just look at me, say something, who are you? I said to him, I want to convince myself that you are Israeli or Jewish or Israeli soldier. He said, yes. I said, but you are very kindness now, very, very nice guy. You don't you see yourself in the checkpoints. You look like a god. He said, absolutely, you are right. Then I said, you know that you are just a criminal. He said, I agree with you. He don't give me any chance to fight. And he said, all what I do, I consider it's a terrorism. And I am here now because I realized that I just create more enemies and more terrorists and more violence. And this was the beginning. At the first, we think as a Palestinian that this group are maybe belong to the Israeli intelligence or Israeli Shabak, and they came to kidnap us.
Oh, you thought maybe this was a trick, this meeting?
Yeah. And I understand that after that, the Israelis think also about the same, maybe those terrorist Palestinians kidnap us or kill us. And we agree in the final of this meeting to make another meeting after 2 weeks just to know more one about the other. In the other meeting, it was around 4 hours. We know that we are going to work a long time together. We realize that we are fighting for the same thing. We want this simple peace to protect our civilians, to grow our children in a peaceful atmosphere. That's it.
Yonatan, what do you remember that was difficult from that first meeting?
At the end of that meeting, when they accompanied us out on our way back to the cars, back to our homes, I felt that I'm being protected by them in a way. And I had to convince myself that I'm feeling something that is real. You know, your former enemy is the one you have to have next to you now when you are walking around the Palestinian territories.
These are the guys you have to trust,
These are the guys I had to trust, and I think that was a very strong emotional moment to understand that actually now they protect us in a way.
It was a year and a half before the Combatants for Peace went public. They held their news conference at a table that was attached to the wall that separates Israelis and Palestinians. There were 120 former fighters, 60 from each side, along with hundreds of guests and many members of the media.
It was very surreal in a way because on the back of the wall where we had the event, the concrete machines that were building the wall were still working. So you could hear the wall being built while all these ex-fighters were standing there talking about peace and solutions and nonviolent. And even during the event, the Israeli army, the soldiers threw a shock grenade that exploded above the heads of the guests and the speakers. It was really like a scene of from a film. We are standing there talking about the nonviolent struggle for freedom and for justice and for peace for all. And the army is throwing a shock grenade above our heads.
Bassam, what did that day mean to you?
It was a very important day for me that we can now speak loudly about what I believe. And from this event, we became more commitment to our group and to our principles. And from this moment, we start to bring a new people. Yeah, it was a very important day.
Both Yonatan Shapira and Bassam Araman would discover that their own commitment to peace would meet its most severe test in January of 2007. That's when Bassam's 10-year-old daughter, Abir, was shot and killed. We'll talk about that next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. If you talk to anyone who lives in Israel or the Palestinian territories, they'll tell you that they soon develop a sense of fatalism. Knowing that a bomb or a bullet could shatter any moment of any day, you learn to live life despite that. Today on The Story, Yonatan Shapira and Bassam Araman have been telling me how they set aside their roles as combatants to work for peace in the Mideast. But January 16th of last year, the violence came back into their lives. The way Bassam remembers that day, both he and his wife had argued with their 10-year-old daughter, Abir. And it had happened as Abir left for school.
She told her mom that she's going to be late. She wants to visit her friend. Then my wife wake me up to prevent her to go to be late. Then I remember I look at her and she said, I'm going to be late. I said, you never even thought about this. After your examination, you must go back directly. And when I came from my work, I'll help you.
You told her she was not allowed to visit her friend. Is that right?
Yeah, she looked at me and in spite of that, she said, I'll be late, then she leave. This is the last time I saw Abir.
She was 10 years old, yeah?
Yeah.
What happened to her on that day?
Across the road beside the school, I see an Israeli border police jeep stand there. Then I start to look at the side of the school to see Abir and Arin, my daughters, to tell them to go directly to the home, but I don't see them. After 15 minutes, I have a phone from the school. They told me that Abir fell down. They want her mom. Then I call home. It was Arin, my big daughter. She cannot speak to me. She's crying and shouting. And her friend took the phone and told me that Abir have been shot in her hand and injured by the Israelis. Of course, it was a shock. I stopped the car and took another car and go back. The school, they told me that they bring her to Al-Maqasid Hospital in East Jerusalem. When I reached there, I saw her. I knew that she's in a very difficult situation. And my doctor, my friend, he's a doctor, he told me that she needs a miracle to stay alive. But because Abir have an Israeli ID, I prefer to take her to the Israeli hospital, which is better. Then she spent 2 days and she died.
She'd been shot in the head with a rubber bullet.
Yeah.
Was there ever any question, any doubt, who shot that bullet?
No, never. It's just one shot. It's one shot.
Did you ever find out how it happened?
From the witness. One from them say, I see one stone throwing in the direction of the jeep. And the other said, we don't see anything. They are kids also, the Israeli soldiers. I think they are teenagers. They start to, their background, they look at our children as a suspect people, as enemies, as also son of enemies. They can make what they want. They can say that it was a big demonstration. They are in a real danger situation. But the fact it was very quiet day, and they shot Abir from a distance of 15 meters just directly in her head and back. And the driver opened the door and looked at her while she fell down and continued walking. I met the same driver after just 2 weeks. And he told me that we shot her because throw stones on us. They know that they shot her and he see her. Why they don't go to help her, to bring her to the hospital? It's very clear. And I haven't any doubt that the Israeli border police killed Abir.
Wassam, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
At this point, you had been working for peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis for almost 15 years. And then your daughter is killed in this way by an Israeli border guard. What were you thinking? That it was all for nothing?
No, actually, I am going to continue my work. It looks like crazy, but this is what had happened. Before more than 2 years, or 3 years even, with the Combatants for Peace, we are calling for protect the civilians, our children. They are very innocent people, especially the kids. And I have also another 5 kids. I want to protect them. My Palestinian and Israeli friends have also kids, not Palestinian and not Israeli and not American, to suffer and to know the taste of the bitterness of the pain which I cross when my beautiful daughter have been killed for nothing.
I don't think I would have reached the same conclusion. I think I would have been too angry.
It's very normal. But in our case, we haven't any choice. You can go to revenge. It's very easy. But you will solve your problem. What can I do? I just can go to kill 1 or 2 or 5 Israeli soldiers. We will still in the same circle of violence, circle of revenge, which is not our way and it's not our solution.
I mentioned earlier on the program that Bassam Araman wrote an essay about the death of his daughter just weeks after she was shot and killed. He wrote that, among those who never left my side were a number of men I have recently come to love as brothers, men who know my past and who share it, men who, like me, were trained to hate and to kill, but who now also believe that we must find a way to live with our former enemies. Bassam's friend, Yonatan, the former Israeli pilot, is one of those men.
One thing that I immediately did was I had to call all my friends from the Air Force that still continue to have contact with me and talk to me. I had to tell them about Bassam and about Abir, and I wanted them to understand that I see them as responsible for this killing. And that was very hard for me to continue to be calm and to accept, you know, people that think different than me. And I'm still struggling with the same idea that I have to talk to these people and convince them that they must act like us and not continue to drop bombs and to shoot missiles. But I think the fact that now I have a personal contact to someone so innocent and so pure that was killed changed something in the way I can cope with these contradictions.
There must have been a small part of you, Yonatan, though, when you heard the news that thought, this is never going to work. We can do all these things to fight for peace, but if 10-year-old girls are shot in the back of the head, what's the point? We can never win.
I didn't have this kind of thought because, unfortunately, Abir is someone I knew and I'm a friend with Bassam, and I learned to respect him and to love him as a friend. But unfortunately, she's just one more child in a long, long list of children that were already killed, children that were killed by my friends, by my army. So that was, in a way, nothing was new here. It was just the statistic this time hit us closer. And it was very important for me to hear Bassam's reaction and to see how he decided that not just he will not stop struggling together with us, he will make it even stronger, in a way made me believe even more in the way that we are struggling.
Yonatan Shapira also made the point that Israeli children are victims of the violence as well. He and Bassam Araman are taking part in a vigil for peace today outside the Israeli embassy in Washington.
עצום עיניים, נו מי בת גם את מי שלא נרדם עדיין ירדם מיד, ירדם מיד.
This song is a lullaby. It was written by Yonatan Shapira. The literal translation is sleep tight. Yonatan calls it a political lullaby to dead children and a sleeping society.
לנתי ולילה טוב לדם Laila tov neda, nu 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 nu.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. On Monday of this week, my guest was an Episcopal preacher who spent the summer of 1961 with the family of Dr. Martin Luther King. Gurdon Brewster lived in the home of Dr. King's father, also a Baptist preacher. Most people called him Daddy King.
I was the only white person in the congregation, and they started to sing the hymn. Reverend King came over and handed me a Bible and said, Brewster, you're going to preach after the service. And I had never preached a sermon in my life, and so I totally panicked. I looked in the Bible, and I found the Sermon on the Mount and began to read it from the Bible and then preached a sermon. And as soon as I read it, somebody in the front row said, Amen, and another one said, Preach it, Brewster, and then somebody said, Hallelujah, and it scared me out of my wits. I had never been in a service where people 8 feet away, 10 feet away were shouting back at me with enthusiasm, so that really did scare me out of my wits.
Gurdon Brewster's recollections prompted a number of responses from you. Vic Camello wrote in from Chicago to say, listening to your Dr. Martin Luther King Day program reminded me of my inadvertent contribution to the civil rights movement back in the early 60s. The important word here, as Vic explained to me, is inadvertent.
Well, my own house was a bit of a battlefield because my folks were quite racist and quite prejudicial to blacks and Jews. And so my father was a kind of person who would yell at the television watching the news. And when I couldn't stand any more of his comments, I would chime in, which would generally lead to an argument.
I have this kind of image of you as Meathead and your dad as Archie Bunker quarreling it out in the living room, all in the family.
That's a great analogy. that was probably, I mean, they were all staunch conservative Republicans, and I always tended to be liberal.
Vic says he made his first trip south from Chicago in 1962. He went to visit a friend in South Carolina. He was 22 years old and still not really ready to step into a part of the country where segregation was still the norm. He was just getting ready to disembark from the train at the station in Atlanta.
There was a woman, a black woman, who was pregnant, facing me, ready to go out at the same time that I was. And I just stopped and said, you know, go ahead. And she said, no. And she said, you go ahead. And I couldn't really understand it until I looked behind her, and everyone behind her was black. And I caught on at that moment that it was the practice for black people at that time to wait until all white people had exited a train before they exited the train.
Even if someone like yourself said, no, you go ahead,
right,
she wasn't going to do it.
No, absolutely, she was not going to move.
So how long did you wait there facing her before you got off the train?
Well, as soon as I saw that everyone behind her was also black, that somehow people had lined up naturally, one black row and one white row, and that I was holding up the whites, basically. I just left.
What were you thinking? I mean, you're trying an after you, ma'am, and nobody's picking up on it, and so you end up just behaving like every other white person was behaving in Atlanta in 1962 of that time. You weren't changing anything.
No. Well, I really wasn't trying to change anything. I was acting kind of normally for myself. I mean, if I was in downtown Chicago and a black woman was behind me and we were going through doors to a store, I would have done exactly the same thing. So I was acting the way I acted in Chicago. I wasn't trying to make a point. And in Chicago, the black women would have gone through the door and maybe said thank you.
You had kind of an interesting bus ride from Clemson, South Carolina, back to Atlanta. Tell me what happened there.
Well, I boarded the bus, and I wanted to have my luggage directly above me in the clothes rack, in the luggage rack, directly above where I sat. And all the white people were in the front section, as it turned out, and they scooted over for me. Even though it was very crowded, they made room, but I looked around and I couldn't see any space for my luggage on the rack. So I didn't even think anything about staying in the front section. I just kept moving in the back, looking at nothing but the luggage racks on either side, so that I had to go pretty far into the back before I found an opening. And I was about to place my bag up there when I heard a woman say, "He doesn't know." And it was at that time that I looked down and discovered that I was in the back of the bus with all the black people.
And what did you think?
Well, at first, I was kind of amused by it. And I said, I don't mind if you don't. And I simply sat down. But then I tried to make conversation with, there was a woman next to me. I tried to make small talk. And nobody would talk to me or have anything to do with me. Wouldn't even look at me. So I sensed that I had created a lot of tension. And there was about four or five stops before we got to Atlanta. And at each small town, black people would, of course, get on. And they would get a big laugh at the fact that I was back there.
Laughing and at you or laughing with the other passengers?
Just at the situation.
Yeah.
I mean, a huge laugh. And then they would try to engage the people who were there in conversation, and the people who were there, again, wouldn't say anything. I mean, nobody spoke in the back of the bus. Nobody said a word.
Did it ever occur to you during the time that you were on the bus, Vic, that maybe you were making things uncomfortable for them, too uncomfortable for them, and it might have been a better thing for you to get, you know, up from your seat and move to the front of the bus? I think I probably would have done what you did, but, you know, getting that kind of reaction, maybe it wasn't such a smart thing to do.
Well, I think you're right. In retrospect, I did create a bad situation for them, but I wasn't moving. In fact, once I was there, I was happy to be there in the back of the bus as a kind of reverse freedom rider. And since then, I've tried to take pride in it, that, you know, in a mini micro way, I participated in the civil rights struggle, and I'm happy I did it.
So you were kind of a closet troublemaker after all.
Yeah.
Vic Camello joined me from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. If you have a story you'd like to share with me, I'm easy to find. Go to our website at thestory.org. You'll find a couple of buttons there that you can press and write a note to tell us here what your story is. Just a few lines is all we need, and one of the producers at The Story will get in touch with you. So the website, thestory.org, or you can call and leave a message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.